guide people with their unhealthy balances, and to kind of point them in the right direction when they get out of balance, because it's very easy to do. I mean, I can do it myself, and that's what my sponsor gets the big bucks for, you know? He points me in the right direction. We think it dangerous if he rushes headlong at his economic problem. The family will be affected also, pleasantly at first, but as they feel their money troubles are about to be solved, then not so pleasantly as they find themselves neglected. Dad may be tired at night and preoccupied by day. He may take small interest in the children and may show irritation when reproved for his delinquencies. If not irritable, he may seem dull and boring, not gay and affectionate as the family would like him to be. Mother may complain of inattention. They are all disappointed and often let him feel it. Beginning with such complaints, a barrier arises. He is straining every nerve to make up for lost time. He is striving to recover fortune and reputation and feels he is doing so very well. Sometimes mother and children do not think so. Having been neglected and misused in the past, they think father owes them more than they are getting. They want him to make a fuss over them. They expect him to give them the nice things they used to have before he drank so much and to show his contrition for what they suffered. But dad doesn't give freely of himself. Resentment grows. He becomes still less communicative. Sometimes he explodes over a trifle. Has anyone in here in early recovery ever exploded over a trifle? Goddamn ice cube tray's empty, goddamn it! That was me. Don't you know I need ice? The family is mystified. They criticize, pointing out how he is falling down on his spiritual program. Boy, those AA meetings sure are helping you. This sort of thing can be avoided. Both father and the family are mistaken, though each side may have some justification. It is of little use to argue and only makes the impasse worse. The family must realize that dad, though marvelously improved, is still convalescing. Absolutely. They should be thankful he is sober and able to be of this world once more. Let them praise his progress. Let them remember that his drinking wrought all kinds of damage that may take long to repair. If they sense these things, they will not take so seriously his periods of crankiness, depression, or apathy, which will disappear when there is tolerance, love, and spiritual understanding. Mm. That's great. You know, first thing I did was show this to my family. Read this right here. Read this sentence. This is what you're supposed to do. The head of the house ought to remember that he is mainly to blame for what befell his home. Mm. He can scarcely square the account in his lifetime. How about that one? That's what living amends are for. But he must see the danger of over-concentration on financial success. Although financial recovery is on the way for many of us, we found that we could not place money first. I'm working with somebody right now who is desperate to get sober. Absolutely. 2 o'clock in the morning, phone calls, the whole deal. Absolutely desperate to get sober, but he cannot go to meetings. You just don't understand. His work is very important. And when you explain to him, well, whatever you put in front of your meetings and your recovery program, you're bound to lose. It's like the eyes glaze over, you know, like that's a propaganda or something. And we'll find out when he comes back from the Salvation Army after drum lessons, you know. Not that we judge. Anyway, for us, material well-being always followed spiritual progress. It never preceded it. What a great sentence that is. Mm. Underline, highlight, put an asterisk. Okay. One thing I'd just like to talk about for a minute. I usually talk about some different thing before we get started every week. And what I'd like to talk about tonight is the set-aside prayer that we do, rather than the serenity prayer. And for anybody that's not familiar with it, the idea of it all is to go into this particular big book meeting with an open mind. So many times the alcoholic has got something figured out to the point where when they hear something that doesn't exactly fit with their idea of recovery or their idea of AA or their idea of God or their idea of working a step, they'll immediately reject it out of hand because that's not the way they did it, or that's not the way their sponsor told them to do it, or they've got a different way of doing it. And what we want to promote really in this meeting is a sense of open-mindedness. We're not trying to convince you that this is the correct interpretation of the Big Book, that my interpretation is the exactly perfect interpretation of the Big Book. That's certainly not true. As a matter of fact, many times in this meeting, I've been corrected by someone and come to find out that there is a better interpretation, or one that makes more sense than the one that I had previously. So hopefully, myself included, I want to be open to being able to grow with this material and to be able to expand on what I already know, or be open to a completely new conception. All these things are possible. So what we do in the beginning is we ask God to set aside our prejudices or our preconceived ideas, and just try to be open-minded for this next hour. And some people can do it and some people can't. But I think it's a good attitude to try to have. Tonight we're on the chapter, The Family Afterward. We're on page 127, paragraph 2. Since the home has suffered more than anything else, it is well that a man exert himself there. He is not likely to get far in any direction if he fails to show unselfishness and love under his own roof. We know there are difficult wives and families, but the man who is getting over alcoholism must remember he did much to make them so. And that certainly is true. I know that living under the same roof as me when I was in my active alcoholism was a difficult task for anybody. And I know that there was a certain amount of sickness that you must have experienced by living and caring for me in the same house. As each member of a resentful family begins to see his shortcomings and admits them to the others, he lays a basis for helpful discussion. These family talks will be constructive if they can be carried on without heated argument, self-pity, self-justification, or resentful criticism. So there are some guiding principles to how to have the constructive family talks. I believe that this is based in early sobriety, but it certainly can move on into upper sobriety or long-term sobriety. Little by little, mother and children will see that they ask too much, and father will see that he gives too little. Giving rather than getting will become the guiding principle. One of the great things that I heard not very far back was, bring to a relationship what you want to get out of it. Bring to any type of relationship the respect that you want to get, the caring that you want to receive. Bring everything that you want would like to receive yourself to the relationship, and amazing things will happen. And they're telling us that this will certainly be the case with our family life, all but in the most difficult situations. There are difficult wives. And I'm sure that they mean husbands also. Assume, on the other hand, that father has, at the outset, a stirring spiritual experience. Overnight, as it were, he is a different man. He becomes a religious enthusiast. He is unable to focus on anything else. As soon as his sobriety begins to be taken as a matter of course, the family may look at their strange new dad with apprehension and with irritation. I know somebody very close to me who this happened to. He got sober, and I mean, he'd been, you know exactly who I'm talking about there. He had been a terror in this family. And all of a sudden, he sits down one night at the kitchen table at dinner and he goes, "Let's all pray." And his family looked at him, and basically his wife said, you were a nut job when you were drinking. Now you're really over the edge. You know, I'm getting rid of your ass." And she got rid of him. So I think he moved on to better things. But there is talk about spiritual matters morning, noon, and night. He may demand that the family find God in a hurry or exhibit amazing indifference to them and say he is above worldly considerations. He may tell mother, who has been religious all her life, that she doesn't know what it's all about. and that she had better get his brand of spirituality while there is yet time. Now, this is a form of spiritual arrogance. Several weeks ago in this meeting, I read a paragraph out of a Packer book that I thought was really wonderful, because what I've seen happen in a lot of cases is the people who get the so-called big book recovery will go out and criticize people with 20 or 30 years, like right out the get-go, and they've got like 2 months sobriety. I mean, that's a form of spiritual arrogance that's going to get you nowhere. You know what I mean? We have a common problem, and yes, we have a common solution. And some of us may think that we've found the exact common solution and go about spouting that. And in some cases, it's appropriate, and in some cases, it's just going to alienate you. You need to understand when it's appropriate and use a little bit of temperance and common sense when it comes to that. But there's definitely, I've been getting a lot of feedback about the people from this meeting, from people with a lot of time saying, you know, these guys are running around preaching the big book to people who've been sober for 20 years. Where the hell do they get their nerve? You know, so I mean, you really have to use a little bit of common sense when you're talking about this stuff, because I'll tell you what, we can help more people if we don't alienate them than if we do. You know what I mean? Let your actions be the proof that you're working a good program, and not always your words. I'll jump down off the soapbox. When father takes this tack, the family may react unfavorably. They may be jealous of a god who has stolen dad's affections. While grateful that he drinks no more, they may not like the idea that God has accomplished the miracle where they failed. You know, the husband of the family, he's an alcoholic, he's been drinking for 20 years. The wife has done everything in the world, spent all this money on psychologists and psychiatrists and, you know, sent him to health farms and all this stuff. And he goes off to AA one day and meets a plumber named Wally and never takes another drink, you know? And they're like, what the hell did Wally say? You know what I mean? Who's this Wally? And I swear to God, there's like a they think there's a cult somewhere that they're not privy to the information of, and a lot of times there's a lot of fear generated in the family. Like, you know, you're getting involved with those A&As. You're going to be selling flowers at airports soon. You know, so they often forget father was beyond human aid. They may not see why their love and devotion did not straighten him out. That is not so spiritual after all, they say. If he means to right his past wrongs, why all this concern for everyone in the world but his family? What about his talk that God will take care of them? They suspect father is a bit balmy. He is not so unbalanced as they might think. Many of us have experienced dad's elation. We have indulged in spiritual intoxication. Like a gaunt prospector belt drawn in over the last ounce of food, our pick struck gold. Joy in our release from a lifetime of frustration knew no bounds. Father feels he was struck. He has struck something better than gold. For a time, he may try to hug the new treasure to himself. He may not see at once that he has barely scratched a limitless lode, which will pay dividends only if he mines it for the rest of his life and insists on giving away the entire product. What a great parallel. What a great euphemism or whatever. Think of your sobriety. You have scarcely scratched a limitless load of recovery, which will pay. You have scarcely scratched a limitless load of recovery, which will pay dividends only if you mine it for the rest of your life and give away everything that you get. You know, that is so true. If the family cooperates, dad will see that he is suffering from a distortion of values. He will perceive that his spiritual growth is lopsided, that for an average man like himself, a spiritual life which does not include his family obligations may not be so perfect after all. We're talking about balance here. And a lot of times you see people, I believe it's fine to be unbalanced at first. At first, I don't think you can get enough AA, you know what I mean, in your first year or so. But there's going to come a time when you're going to have to take responsibility for the rest of the stuff that surrounds your life, your family life, your work environment, community affairs, you know, whatever. I've seen people literally hide in AA with 15, 20 years, going to 2 or 3 meetings a day, have nothing to do with their family, and be like retired and just do nothing but AA. And I don't think that's healthy either. You know what I mean? If the family will appreciate that Dad's current behavior is but a phase of his development, all will be well. In the midst of an understanding and sympathetic family, these vagaries of Dad's spiritual infancy will quickly disappear. The opposite may happen should the family condemn and criticize. Dad may feel that for years his drinking has placed him on the wrong side of every argument, but now that he has become a superior person with God on his side. If the family persists in criticism, this fallacy may take a still greater hold on Father. Instead of treating the family as he should, he may retreat further into himself and feel he has a spiritual justification for doing so. Though the family does not fully agree with Dad's spiritual activities, they should let him have his head. Remember, this was written by an alcoholic. You know, there's like an alcoholic slant on a lot of this stuff. I don't think the Al-Anons would change a few of these sentences if we gave him a chance. Even if he displays a certain amount of neglect and irresponsibility towards the family, it is well to let him go as far as he likes in helping other alcoholics. Until you start bringing them home, they start lighting the couch on fire. It takes a couch about 2 days to burn up. You know, they just smolder. Has anybody noticed that? During those first days of convalescence, this will do more to ensure his sobriety than anything else. Though some of his manifestations are alarming and disagreeable, we think Dad will be on firmer foundation than the man who is placing business or professional success ahead of spiritual development. He will be less likely to drink again, and anything is preferable to that. I spoke again last week about somebody that I've been working with on and on for a long, long time, who is, he'll call you up, he'll be absolutely desperate to recover. I'll do anything this time. Okay, meet me at the meeting tonight. Oh, I can't. His life is just way too important to spend it sitting in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, you know. There's got to be a better way. Can't you give me recovery on a silver platter, please? Isn't there a shot I can take? You know what I mean? I swear to God, it's unbelievable. The people that rush right back into business are usually, if they stay sober, they're usually so uncomfortable with untreated alcoholism. You know, the kind of, you know, gritting their teeth and yelling at employees and, you know, resentful at everything. I think it's better to keep a good, healthy balance for quite a while with meetings and recovery. Those of us who have spent much time in the world of spiritual make-believe have eventually seen the childlessness of it. This dream world has been replaced by a great sense of purpose, accompanied by a growing consciousness of the power of God in our lives. We have come to believe he would like us to keep our heads in the clouds with him, but that our feet ought to be firmly planted on earth. Amen to that. Again, I've seen a few people come in who were pagans, and a few months into sobriety, they start to become born again Christians, and they don't want to associate with the likes of us anymore, and they're gone. And who knows where they go? I'm not saying all born again Christians do this. I'm saying that I've seen some people get so fanatically religious that they don't want to have anything to do with the people in AA. So they let what AA give them take them away from AA. And that's a crime, I think. That is where our fellow travelers are, and that is where our work must be done. These are the realities for us. We have found nothing incompatible between a powerful spiritual experience and a life of sane and happy usefulness. One more suggestion: whether the family has spiritual convictions or not, they may do well to examine the principles by which the alcoholic member is trying to live. They can hardly fail to approve these simple principles, though the head of the house still fails somewhat in practicing them. Somewhat is probably an understatement. Nothing will help the man who is off on a spiritual tangent so much as the wife who adopts a sane spiritual program, making a better practical use of it. You know, that's a good one. There will be other profound changes in the household. Liquor incapacitated father for so many years that mother became head of the house. She met these responsibilities gallantly. By fearsome circumstances, she was often obliged to treat father as a sick or wayward child. Even when he wanted to assert himself, he could not, for drinking placed him constantly in the wrong. Mother made all the plans and gave the directions. When sober, the father usually obeyed. Thus, mother, though through no fault of her own, became accustomed to wearing the family trousers. Father, coming suddenly to life again, often begins to assert himself. This means trouble unless the family watches for these tendencies in each other and comes to a friendly agreement about them. I was sponsoring one guy one time who, he had turned over everything to his wife except his business affairs and his drinking. Those are the two things that he could still kind of handle, except his drinking got out of control, but he could still manage his business. He had his own business. So he gets sober, and all of a sudden he wants to know, he picks up the checkbook, and he wants to know what all these checks are for. Well, she went absolutely apeshit on him, you know? What do you care where those checks are going? You know, where have you been the last 20 years? So you really have to watch it when you start inserting yourself back into an authoritarian position in the family management. If you haven't been there in a while, you got to kind of do it slowly if you're going to do it. Drinking isolates most homes from the outside world. Father may have laid aside for years all normal activities, clubs, civic duties, sports. When he renews interest in such things, a feeling of jealousy may arise. The family may feel they hold a mortgage on Dad so big that no equity should be left for outsiders. Instead of developing new channels of activity for themselves, mother and children demand that he stay home and make up the deficiency. I'm working with a guy right now. He comes back, he goes out. He tells me that the biggest problem he has is his wife doesn't want him to go into AA. I said, well, dump her. You know? Well, because you're going to lose her anyway if you keep drinking. So what do you want to be, sober and loser or drinking and loser? You know what I mean? If she has that, because I don't really believe she's got that big of a problem with AA. I think that that's an excuse he's using. So, because I really truly can't see anybody saying, oh, you have to take that insulin again tonight, honey? You know? Aren't you leaning on that a little bit too heavy? Or don't tell me you've got to go for dialysis again this week. You know? I mean, that's what it's like. It's like saying. So anyway, I said, well, if she's stopping you from going to meetings, get rid of her. Show her the door. Tell her, don't let the door hit you in the ass, honey. At the very beginning, the couple ought to frankly face the fact that each will have to yield here if the family is going to play an effective part in the new life. Father will necessarily spend much time with other alcoholics, but this activity should be balanced. New acquaintances who know nothing of alcoholism might be made and thoughtful consideration given to their needs. The problems of the community might engage attention. Though the family has no religious connections, they may wish to make contact with or take membership in a religious body. That was a very big thing in the early days, although not absolutely vital, it was certainly encouraged. Alcoholics who have derided religious people will be helped by such contacts. Being possessed of a spiritual experience, the alcoholic will find he has much in common with these people, though he may differ with them on many matters. If he does not argue about religion, he will make new friends and is sure to find new avenues of unselfish, usefulness and pleasure. That was my problem with religion. I never could walk into a church because I argued about their policy. You know, their policy didn't make sense to me, and I wasn't really happy with it. So I prejudiced myself right out of any benefits that I could have gotten from religion. He and his family can be a bright spot in such congregations. That's a nice promise. If we get sober, we have a spiritual experience, and we return to a church, we can be a bright spot in that church. He may bring new hope and new courage to many a priest, minister, or rabbi who gives all his all to minister to our troubled world. We intend the foregoing as a helpful suggestion only. So far as we are concerned, there is nothing obligatory about it. As non-denominational people, we cannot make up others' minds for them. Each individual should consult his own conscience. We have been speaking to you of serious, sometimes tragic things. We have been dealing with alcohol in its worst aspect, but we aren't a glum lot. If newcomers could see no joy or fun in our existence, they wouldn't want it. Have you ever been to one of those dark tunnel meetings where everybody just sits around like this? You tell a joke and they don't even smile. I mean, I've spoke at some meetings like that. There's like seven guys and they're all like 60 years old and they just sit there like this. You know, I'm sober one more day today. And that's all you got today. You just got today. I mean, those are the type of people that we're talking about here. We absolutely insist upon enjoying life. You know, if you're sober and you've recovered, tell your face for God's sake. You know, you feel like telling these people, you know, get a goddamn life, and go to a meeting where there's some enthusiasm and close that one down. You know what I mean? Not that I judge. We absolutely insist upon enjoying life. We try not to indulge in cynicism over the state of the nations, nor do we carry the world's troubles on our shoulders. You know, I used to just, why are you drinking today? Oh, because of the troubles in the Middle East. You know, good reason. When we see a man sinking into the mire that is alcoholism, we give him first aid and place what we have at his disposal. For his sake, we do recount and almost relive the horrors of our past. But those of us who have tried to shoulder the entire burden and trouble of others find we are soon overcome by them. So we think cheerfulness and laughter make for usefulness. Outsiders are sometimes shocked when we burst into merriment over a seemingly tragic experience out of the past. But why shouldn't we laugh? We have recovered and have been given the power to help others. That's a good promise. Everybody knows that those in bad health and those who seldom pray do not laugh much. So let each family play together or separately as much as their circumstances warrant. We are sure God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. Absolutely. We cannot subscribe to the belief that this life is a veil of tears, though it was once for that for many of us. But it is clear that we made our own misery. God did not do it. We have self-will. We allowed self-will to run riot. Our troubles are of our own making. And that's not an easy pill to swallow when you walk in here. But if you don't swallow it, you're not going to get free. Because if all your troubles are out there is not going to change. How are you going to change everything out there? So you're going to be a slave to it all still. But if you come to the realization that your troubles are of your own making, there's a way to get free of it, and this book will show you. Avoid then the deliberate manufacture of misery. But if trouble comes, cheerfully capitalize it as an opportunity to demonstrate his omnipotence. Usually, I like to start off with a reading of one kind or another, usually non-conference approved. But I want to. Dave sent me an email today, and I want to talk about this just for a brief moment. Basically, these are the 1998 chip sales by the Houston Area Intergroup of Alcoholics Anonymous. What they do in the South is they do a poker chip system. You get a white, I believe it's a white desire chip. And what that is that's like getting a 24-hour coin up here. It's you're deciding to get sober and it's your first meeting. There were 19,000 desire chips in the Houston area purchased in 1998. There were 7,900 1 month. There was 5,400 2 month. There was 4,700 3 month. And you look down here at a year, there was 1,800 one-year chips. That's less than 1 in 10. So if you assume that the people who get a desire chip, if they're sober, they'll get a one-year chip, we're looking at less than 1 in 10 people stay sober a year who come in desiring to stop drinking. And if you go down to like, let's go to 8 years, that's 557 eight-year chips. That's like 40 to 1. Okay? The reason I'm talking about this is because if you're anything like me and you come into Alcoholics Anonymous, you don't want to drink again. I did not decide to come into AA to take a month off of drinking or something. My life was such in the shitter that I just couldn't possibly go on living drinking, and I couldn't go on living without drinking. And you know, when I came in, I had decided that it was going to be for good and for all, if I could, to not drink again. And it's saying here that it's that you have a 1 in 40 chance of going 8 years when you walk through the door. Now, why is that? It says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed the path. Well, then how come 1 in 40 stays sober 8 years, if you believe these statistics? And I've got my own theory on that, and that's basically that you don't see 39 of them following the path. And really, that's what this meeting was basically brought into being about. It's about people sharing their current experience on how you practice the principles, how you thoroughly follow the path. And I believe that the people that come to this meeting here are interested in learning and sharing their experience about that, because it's very important. I don't know what happens to the 39 other people in the Houston area. I don't want to know. Because when we go back out, it's not a pretty sight. You know, we don't win awards for being good people and things like that. You know, we don't get Nobel Peace Prizes and shit like that. Just awful things happen to us. So anyway, we're... Yeah, let's go to 20 years. I didn't want to depress anybody too much. 177 20-year chips and 3 40-year chips.
The reason I chose 40-year chips, 177 versus 19,000. That's like 40,000. We've been front of the big book. When we had 20 years, 1955, and they published the second edition, they listed the statistics in the board.
1%. So anyway, the positive thing about these statistics really is you don't have to be one of the 39. The proper use of the willpower is to thoroughly follow the path. And we can do that if we know what it is. And we're going to talk a little bit about that tonight. We're going to start on page 133 in the family afterward. One paragraph down.
What page?
133. Now about health. A body badly burned by alcohol does not often recover overnight, nor do twisted thinking and depression vanish in a twinkling. We are convinced that a spiritual mode of living is the most powerful health restorative. That's a nice statement right there. And I've found that to be true. We who have recovered from serious drinking are miracles of mental health. But we have seen remarkable transformations in our bodies. Hardly one of our crowd now shows any mark of dissipation. This isn't always true, but it's certainly true in my case. I bumped into my ex-boss making an amends, and he hadn't seen me in about 7 or 8 years. And his words to me were, "Chris, you're a young man." That's what he said. I looked older 8 years before when I was drinking than I do now that I'm sober. It's absolutely true. And I believe in body, mind, and spirit, so I exercise a lot. I'm probably in the best physical condition that I've ever been in. That's not always true, but it certainly can be. At least we're afforded the opportunity if we stay sober. But this does not mean that we disregard human health measures. God has abundantly supplied this world with fine doctors, psychologists, and practitioners of various kinds. Do not hesitate to take your health problems to such persons. I'm glad that it doesn't say drinking problems. Most of them give freely of themselves that their fellows may enjoy sound minds and bodies. Try to remember that though God has wrought miracles among us, we should never belittle a good doctor or psychiatrist. Their services are often indispensable in treating a newcomer and in following his case afterward. One of the many doctors who had the opportunity of reading this book in manuscript form told us that the use of sweets was often helpful, of course, depending upon a doctor's advice. He thought all alcoholics should constantly have chocolate available for its quick energy value at times of fatigue. They've learned a lot about alcoholism since these days. And you go into a sugar withdrawal when you quit drinking. If you've really been drinking like a sumbitch, you go into sugar withdrawal when you start detoxing. Because your body is used to absorbing a lot of sugar. Alcohol is hugely filled with sugar. So all of a sudden you're not drinking the sugar, you're going to bounce all over the place. You're going to chirp like a squirrel. He added that occasionally in the night a vague craving arose which would be satisfied by candy. Many of us have noticed a tendency to eat sweets and have found this practice beneficial. I'm one of them. Yeah, you know what I mean? Maybe one of these days we'll recover from the sugar thing. But I've given up a lot of things on the way, and we'll work on that. A word about sex relations. Alcohol is so sexually stimulating to some men that they have overindulged. Couples are occasionally dismayed to find that when drinking is stopped, the man tends to be impotent. I don't think this is true nowadays, and I think I can prove it with a show of hands. Anybody here that's impotent because of alcohol, please raise their hand. Men in there. See? It just doesn't happen.
Oh,
that's what? One in 30? You know, that's pretty good. Anyway.
Only truthful guy in all.
Yeah, really.
Unless the reason is understood, there may be an emotional upset. I can imagine. Some of us have had this experience, only to enjoy in a few months finer intimacy than ever. There should be no hesitancy in consulting a doctor or psychologist if the condition persists. And we now have that wonder drug, Viagra, for anybody. We do not know of many cases where this difficulty lasted long. The alcoholic may find it hard to reestablish friendly relations with his children. Now, that's certainly true. Their young minds were impressionable when he was drinking. Without saying so, they may cordially hate him for what he has done to them and to their mother. The children are sometimes dominated by a pathetic hardness and cynicism. They cannot seem to forgive and forget. This may hang on for months, long after their mother has accepted Dad's new way of living and thinking. In time, they will see that he is a new man, and in their own way, they will let him know it. When this happens, they can be invited to join in morning meditation, and then they can take part in the daily discussion without rancor or bias. From that point on, progress will be rapid. Marvelous results often follow such a reunion. This has got to be at least the third time they've talked about involving the family in morning meditation. They talk about that being the forgotten paragraph when we're reading the 11th step. But it certainly was an Oxford group practice, and it followed through into early Alcoholics Anonymous as we know it. It's one of those things that I think that they kind of let slide a little bit. You know, you don't see too many sponsors these days really pushing that at home. You know what I mean? But it certainly has its benefits. Whether the family goes on a spiritual basis or not, the alcoholic member has to if he would recover. The others must be convinced of his new status beyond a shadow of a doubt. Seeing is believing, the most families who have lived with a drinker. Here's a case in point. I love this. Remember that Bill Wilson drank like 25 pots of coffee a day, and he smoked himself to death. He had emphysema. His last talk, they had to pump him up with oxygen. And every few minutes, you know, he'd start to go like this, and they'd have to pump the sumbitch up again. You know? I mean, he smoked his lungs right out of his body. So keep that in mind when we're going through this next paragraph. Here's a case in point. One of our friends is a heavy smoker and coffee drinker. There was no doubt he overindulged. Seeing this and meaning to be helpful, his wife commenced to admonish him about it. He probably had current experience with that. He admitted that he was overdoing these things, but frankly said that he was not ready to stop. His wife is one of those persons who really feels there is something rather sinful about these commodities. So she nagged, and her intolerance finally threw him into a fit of anger, and he got drunk. Of course, our friend was wrong, dead wrong. He had to painfully admit that and mend his spiritual fences. Though he is now a most effective member of Alcoholics Anonymous, he still smokes and drinks coffee, but neither his wife nor anyone else stands in judgment. God damn it. She sees she was wrong to make a burning issue out of such a matter when his more serious ailments were being rapidly cured. We have three little mottos which are apropos. Here they are. First things first, and through study of the earlier literature, first things first is basically your recovery. Keep your recovery first. Keep your relationship with God first, and all the other things will follow. Live and let live. That has a lot to do with what we learned in the third and fourth step about how we try to manipulate and control people. And easy does it, which I don't think easy ever did anything for me. But easy does it is one of them. Not one of my favorites, but anyway, let's do a little bit of two employers. Here's some oral history. I'm not absolutely sure about the validity of this because there's just not a lot of people who were alive when this was written that were really connected with it to a great degree. There were some of the secretaries that Bill Wilson had for him, but one of the bits of oral history is a man named Hank Parkhurst was instrumental in writing this chapter. Hank was the type of person who, he actually worked on the Panama Canal, and he was like one of those straw bosses who, he was very, very powerful individual, and he managed a lot of people at one period of time, more so than anybody else really in the group that was pursuing this big book. So the oral history goes that he was really influential in the writing of this chapter. He ended up getting drunk soon after, either after or soon before the big book was published, and got very, very resentful toward Bill Wilson because he thought he would become one of the grand high muckety mucks in Alcoholics Anonymous because of his penning this chapter. And he went about all the AA groups, which there weren't many at this time in the New York area, scumbagging Bill Wilson, saying like what a jerk he was. He ripped me off. And another bit of the oral history was Hank owned a third of the stock in the big book and turned it back over to Bill Wilson and his influence while he was drinking. And found out later that might have been a mistake. How many millions of copies of the big book have been published, Dave? Yeah, that's, even at a buck a book, that was a financial faux pas of magnanimous proportions, I would say. So anyway, whether or not all that's true, that's some of the oral history. Among many employers nowadays, we think of one member who has spent much of his life in the world of big business, and that would be Hank. He has hired and fired hundreds of men. He knows the alcoholics as the employer sees him. His present views ought to prove exceptionally useful to businessmen everywhere, but let him tell you. I was at one time assistant manager of a corporation department employing 6,600 men. One day my secretary came in saying that Mr. B insisted upon speaking with me. I told her to say that I was not interested. I'd warned him several times that he had but one more chance. Not long afterward, he had called me from Hartford on two successive days, so drunk he could hardly speak. I told him he was through, finally and forever. My secretary returned to say that it was not Mr. B on the phone, it was Mr. B's brother, and he wished to give me a message. I still expected a plea for clemency, but these words came through the receiver. I just wanted to tell you, Paul jumped from a hotel window in Hartford last Saturday. He left us a note saying you were the best boss he ever had and that you were not to blame in any way. Another time, as I opened a letter which lay on my desk, a newspaper clipping fell out. It was the obituary of one of the best salesmen I ever had. After 2 weeks of drinking, he had placed his toe on the trigger of a loaded shotgun. The barrel was in his mouth. I had discharged him for drinking 6 days before. Still another experience. A woman's voice came faintly over long distance from Virginia. She wanted to know if her husband's company insurance was still in force. 4 days before, he had hanged himself in his woodshed. I'd been obliged to discharge him for drinking, though he was brilliant, alert, and one of the best organizers I had ever known. We take ourselves out. We do. We get to that point of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, and it's usually after a long spree, and we can't live with alcohol, we can't live without alcohol, and we can't live. And we take ourselves out. One of the amazing statistics that I heard from one of the first 100 was that out of 30 people who wrote stories in the first edition of the Big Book, 8 of them committed suicide after they went back to drinking. That is a huge amount of people out of 30 to commit suicide. This is no game. We get to a point spiritually and mentally drinking where it's absolute agony to go on. And many of us take the final sacrifice. And it's a shame. It's a shame. And it's funny. Usually we don't do it drinking. More often than not, we do it after a spree when we've sobered up. Here were 3 exceptional men lost to this world because I did not understand alcoholism as I do now. What irony. I became an alcoholic myself. And but for the intervention of an understanding person, I might have followed in their footsteps. My downfall cost the business community unknown thousands of dollars, for it takes real money to train a man for an executive position. I heard one time it costs $1 million to train a high-level executive. And I would bet that that's true. This kind of waste goes on unabated. We think the business fabric is shot through with a situation which might be helped by better understanding all around. Nearly every modern employer feels a moral responsibility for the well-being of his help, and he tries to meet these responsibilities. That he has not always done so for the alcoholic is easily understood. To him, the alcoholic often seems a fool of the first magnitude. Because of the employee's special ability or of his own strong personal attachment to him, the employer has somewhat kept such a man at work long beyond a reasonable period. Some employers have tried every known remedy. In only a few instances has there been a lack of patience and tolerance. And we, who have imposed on the best of employers, can scarcely blame them if they've been short with us. Here, for instance, is a typical example. An officer of one of the largest banking institutions in America knows I no longer drink. One day he told me about an executive of the same bank who, from his description, was undoubtedly alcoholic. This seemed to me like an opportunity to be helpful, so I spent 2 hours talking about alcoholism, the malady, and described the symptoms and results as well as I could. His comment was, "Very interesting, but I'm sure this man is done drinking. He has just returned from 3 months' leave of absence, has taken a cure, looks fine, and to clinch the matter, the board of directors have told him that this was his last chance." The only answer I could make was that if the man followed the usual pattern, he would go on a bigger bust than ever. I felt this was inevitable and wondered if the bank was doing the man an injustice. Why not bring him into contact with some of our alcoholic crowd? He might have a chance. I pointed out that I had had nothing to drink whatever for 3 years, and this in the face of difficulties that would have made 9 out of 10 men drink their heads off. Why not at least afford him an opportunity to hear my story? "Oh no," my friend said, "this chap is either through with liquor or he is minus a job. If he has your willpower and guts, he will make the grade." So many people make this mistaken assumption. You know, there's a lot of CAC counselors, there's a lot of human resources department, and more or less I believe that they've been given a lot of information that's much more helpful than to have none at all. But I still run into people who think that because their son, husband, employee, whatever, went through Elena Lodge, they're never going to drink again. And I usually ask a couple questions. How many meetings is the person going to? You know, is he working with a sponsor? Does he know anything about the steps? Is he of service? Does he work with alcoholics? Does he do any service commitments? And that is a better gauge of whether the person is going to drink again or not than whether they went to Elena Lodge. You know what I mean? Whatever spiritual shot you will get from a rehab, if you're a real alcoholic, it's going to wear off. It's going to wear off. I was working with somebody not too long ago who went through Elena Lodge, not to mention any names for God's sake. Oh my God. And I'll tell you what, he relied on Elena Lodge after he got out more than he relied on AA. When he felt like drinking, you know what he did? He drove up to Elena Lodge and spent the night. I swear to God. And I'm like, oh, okay. Well, what happens when they're full, if you're going to use that? You know what I mean? What happens when the car breaks down on the way? If that's going to be your defense against the next drink, driving up and seeing Geraldine's people, you're in deep shit. And that's exactly what happened. He hurt his back. He got a few painkillers, which were doctor prescribed, for God's sake. I listened to my doctor. And, you know, change that old sobriety date, pal. Because you're not looking so good. And I'm telling you, the people that are in fit spiritual condition, smack dab in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, have gotten through major surgery without going back out. I see it all the time. You know, I went through it myself. I've been through two major surgeries and have not used. And I've had to take mood-altering chemicals. They don't operate on you unless they put you out. You know what I mean? I've had to have Percocet. I've had to have morphine. But I'll tell you what, at each period of time, I was... six meetings a week. I was sponsoring like a bastard. I was going through the steps on a yearly or bi-yearly basis. I had service commitments out the wazoo. And I never even came close to picking up. You know what I mean? There is something about keeping yourself smack dab in the middle of the atmosphere of Alcoholics Anonymous that protects you from the next drink. And there's something that doesn't about driving up to Elena Lodge. Not that I judge for God's sake. I wanted to throw up my hands in discouragement, for I saw that I had failed to help my banker friend understand. He simply could not believe that his brother executive suffered from a serious illness. There was nothing to do but wait. Presently, the man did slip and was fired. Following his discharge, we contacted him. Without much ado, he accepted the principles and procedures that had helped us. He is undoubtedly on the road to recovery. And remember, the principles and procedure is what was laid out in the preceding chapters. He followed the instructions as they were laid out in the book. The book hadn't been written yet, but they had the procedures and practices down. They had learned them from the Oxford group. To me, this incident illustrates lack of understanding as to what really ails the alcoholic and lack of knowledge as to what part employers might profitably take in salvaging their sick employees. I've been given some thought to doing something a little bit different. Sometime in the course of this month, what I'd like to do is to set aside two Tuesday meetings for a special presentation, if you will, on the fourth step inventory. And I've asked Dave for his help. And basically what my idea was to, the first week, explain the resentment, fear, and sexual harm inventory. And the second week, get examples from the participants. And basically to, what I've found in my own personal experience is it kind of takes a little practice to be able to get real honest with the inventory. And I think that something in this type of format will be very, very helpful to people who don't have a lot of experience writing inventory. And we'll just have to see how it goes. It's not something that I think that either of us have done in this exact format. But I have a feeling that it'll work out real positively, and I hope everybody would agree to do that and to show up for those two Tuesdays. Anyway, I just want to start off with a reading. This is one of Bill Wilson's writings from Language of the Heart. Language of the Heart basically is a grapevine publication that collects all of his grapevine articles that he wrote over the years. And there's some really wonderful stuff in that book. And here's one here, an excerpt from it. We have since found that these awful conditions of body and mind invariably bring on the third phase of our malady. This is the sickening of the spirit. So as our mind and body are deteriorated by alcoholic drinking, our spirit also starts to suffer. We suffer spiritually. A sickness for which there must necessarily be a spiritual remedy. We recognize this in the first five words of step 12 of the recovery program, having had a spiritual awakening. This really then is the treatment for alcoholism. This brings about the recovery, the spiritual awakening. Here we have the remedy for our threefold sickness of body, mind, and soul. Here we declare the necessity for that all-important spiritual awakening. And from my experience and what I believe today is I believe that the spiritual awakening is a result of the practice of the 12 steps as it's laid out in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. This brings about a spiritual awakening. It certainly did in my case. And we're up here in the chapter, tonight we're in the chapter to employers. And there's about four chapters that I like to categorize as the practice the principles chapters. They give us further examples of how to interact with our environment. And like I said last week, the legend has it that Hank Parkhurst, he's the guy who hustled Bill Wilson into writing the Big Book, really. Bill Wilson dictated most of it to Hank Parkhurst's secretary over in, where was it, Hoboken, New Jersey, or somewhere like that. And this is really how we got this book. But Hank ended up getting drunk. But as legend has it, he's the one that penned the chapter to employers. And one of the reasons why he got a resentment was that he was not going to become one of the exalted great high muckety mucks of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was recognized early on that humility was something that was more and more going to be necessary for personal sobriety and for the safeguarding of our society. And he was just one of those crackerjack kind of guys, you know. He was a pistol, and he ended up getting drunk. So we don't hear much about him these days. But anyway. We're going to start on page 139, paragraph 2. If you desire to help, and we're talking about how the employer can best act with an alcoholic employee. What are some of the actions that we've found work, and what are some of the actions we've found don't? And these are some of the guiding principles for an employer. But the things we learn in this chapter don't necessarily have to stay as an employer. There's many lessons for us in this chapter as well. If you desire to help, it might be well to disregard your own drinking or lack of it. Whether you are a hard drinker, a moderate drinker, or a teetotaler, you may have some pretty strong opinions, perhaps prejudices. Those who drink moderately may be more annoyed with an alcoholic than a total abstainer would be. Drinking occasionally and understanding your own reactions, it is possible for you to become quite sure of many things which, so far as the alcoholic is concerned, are not always so. I'll tell you what, if you're not an alcoholic, you are just not going to understand the self-destructive drinking pattern of the alcoholic. You're going to ask yourself, why? Why do you do that to yourself? You know, why do you do that to your family? It's just... If you're not subject to a mental obsession beyond which you have little or no control, you're not going to understand somebody that does. You're going to think that they're deciding to be self-destructive because there's something wrong with them. You know what I mean? It's like a moral problem or something. As a moderate drinker, you can take your liquor or leave it alone. Whenever you want to, you can control your drinking. Of an evening, you can go on a mild bender, get up in the morning, shake your head, and go to business. To you, liquor is no real problem. You cannot see why it should be to anyone else save the spineless and stupid. When dealing with an alcoholic, there may be a natural annoyance that a man could be so weak, stupid, and irresponsible. Even when you understand the malady better, you may feel this feeling rising. I swear to God, sometimes it does in me. And I've seen it happen in rehabs, you know, places that should know better. And it's happening all across the board with insurance companies. For one reason or another, insurance companies are now being allowed to refuse to pay for treatment for alcoholism. There's something about alcoholism. It's like a dirty disease. If you had cancer, and some of the side effects from cancer were yelling and screaming and, you know, running around naked and stuff like that, I don't think anybody would really think you're a moral leper. But even though the American Medical Association in 1956 declared alcoholism a disease, it still has all kinds of stigma about it, like we're bums and moral reprobates, you know? And I'll tell you, even with people that should know better, like detoxes and places like that, you still can get this attitude. A look at the alcoholic in your organization is many times illuminating. Is he not usually brilliant, fast-thinking, imaginative, and likable? When sober, does he not work hard and have a knack for getting things done? Because we come in Tuesday, we make up for it throughout the rest of the week. You know, we're very hard workers when we put our minds to it. If he had these qualities and did not drink, would he be worth retaining? Should he have the same consideration as other ailing employees? Is he worth salvaging? If your decision is yes, whether the reason be humanitarian or business or both, then the following suggestions may be helpful. Can you discard the feeling that you are dealing only with habit, with stubbornness, or a weak will? If this presents difficulty, rereading chapters 2 and 3 where the alcoholic sickness is discussed at length might be worthwhile. You as a businessman want to know the necessity with stubbornness or a weak will. If this presents difficulty, rereading chapters 2 and 3 where the alcoholic sickness is discussed at length might be worthwhile. You as a businessman want to know the necessities before considering the result. If you concede that your employee is ill, can he be forgiven for what he has done in the past? Can his past absurdities be forgotten? Can it be appreciated that he has been a victim of crooked thinking directly caused by the action of alcohol on his brain? I was one hard-working son of a bitch. I ended up becoming an electrician in my drinking days. You know what I mean? And I was a hard worker. I never had a boss say, "You're a lousy worker, you're fired." That never happened with me. But I would do stupid, absurd things, like in a drunken blackout, call up and quit, and then forget and go in the next morning, you know, because I was in a blackout. I mean, I would do these crazy things, and my bosses may not have had a lot of faith in me, but they knew when I was on the clock, I was making the money. I well remember the shock I received when a prominent doctor in Chicago told me of cases where pressure of the spinal fluid actually ruptured the brain. No wonder an alcoholic is strangely irrational. Who wouldn't be with such a fevered brain? As we have fevered brains. Normal drinkers are not so affected, nor can they understand the aberrations of the alcoholic. Your man has probably been trying to conceal a number of scrapes, perhaps pretty messy ones. They may be disgusting. You may be at a loss to understand how such a seemingly above-board chap would be so involved. But these scrapes can generally be charged, no matter how bad, to the abnormal action of alcohol on his mind. That was nice to find out, I'll tell you. When drinking or getting over a bout, an alcoholic, sometimes the model of honesty when normal, will do incredible things. Afterward, his revulsion will be terrible. Nearly always, these antics indicate nothing more than temporary conditions. This is not to say that all alcoholics are honest and upright when not drinking. Of course, that isn't so, and such people often may impose on you. Seeing your attempt to understand and help, some men will try to take advantage of your kindness. If you are sure your man does not want to stop, he may as well be discharged. The sooner, the better. There you go. That's a good one right there. If somebody does not honestly want to stop, you're aiding and abetting their continuation toward a horrific bottom. You are not doing him a favor by keeping him on. Firing such an individual may prove a blessing to him. It may be just the jolt he needs. I know in my own particular case that nothing my company could have done would have stopped me. For so long as I was able to hold my position, I could not possibly realize how serious my situation was. Had they fired me first, and had they taken steps to see that I was presented with a solution contained in this book, I might have returned to them 6 months later a well man. But there are many men who want to stop, and with them you can go far. Your understanding treatment of their cases will pay dividends. Perhaps you have such a man in mind. He wants to quit drinking, and you want to help him, even if it be only a matter of good business. You now know more about alcoholism. You can see that he is mentally and physically sick. You are willing to overlook his past performances. Suppose an approach is made something like this. State that you know about his drinking and that it must stop. You might say you appreciate his abilities but would like to keep him but cannot if he continues to drink. A firm attitude at this point has helped many of us. Next, he can be assured that you do not intend to lecture, moralize, or condemn, that if this was done formally, it was because of misunderstanding. If possible, express a lack of hard feeling toward him. At this point, it might be well to explain alcoholism, the illness. Say that you believe he is a gravely ill person with this qualification, perhaps fatally ill. Does he want to get well? You ask because many alcoholics, being warped and drugged, do not want to quit. But does he? Will he take every necessary step, submit to anything to get well, to stop drinking forever? That's one of those deadly qualifications again. Are you willing to go to any lengths? This book is shot through with that. Are you willing to go to any lengths? That's what they did with the alcoholic back around the Big Book days. There was none of this half-measure shit. They wouldn't put up with it back then. You know, we have become very, very liberal in the fellowship in what we allow and what we don't allow, and what type of sponsorship we have and what type of sponsorship we don't have. If he says yes, does he really mean it? Or down inside, does he think he is fooling you and that after rest and treatment, he will be able to get away with a few drinks now and then? We believe a man should be thoroughly probed on these points. Be satisfied he's not deceiving himself or you. Whether you mention this book is a matter for your discretion. If he temporizes and still thinks he can ever drink again, even beer, he might as well be discharged after the next bender, which, if an alcoholic, he's almost certain to have. He should understand that emphatically. Either you are dealing with a man who can and will get well, or you are not. If not, why waste time with him? This may seem severe, but is usually the best course. If somebody's not very, very willing to get sober, they did not believe he was going to in the old days. You know, there was no osmosis stuff back then. Either you were willing to join up with the A&As and change your life, or, you know, they didn't think you were a good risk. After satisfying yourself that your man wants to recover and that he will go to any extreme to do so, you may suggest a definite course of action. For most alcoholics who are drinking or who are just getting over a spree, a certain amount of physical treatment is desirable, even imperative. The matter of physical treatment should, of course, be referred to your own doctor. Whatever the method, its object is to thoroughly clear the mind and body of the effects of alcohol, a detoxification process. In competent hands, this seldom takes long, nor is it very expensive. Dr. Bob used to use paraldehyde. He'd give you enough of that, you'd wake up Thursday. I swear to God, you'd be out for 2 or 3 days. Your man will fare better if placed in such physical condition that he can think straight and no longer craves liquor. If you propose such a procedure to him, it may be necessary to advance the cost of treatment. But we believe it should be made plain that any expense will later be deducted from his pay. It is better for him to feel fully responsible. Boy, that's something they don't do today. Deduct your rehab treatment from your pay. You'd be sobering up quick if they were going to be doing that. If your man accepts your offer, it should be pointed out that physical treatment is but a small part of the picture. Though you are providing him with the best possible medical attention, he should understand that he must undergo a change of heart. To get over drinking will require a transformation of thought and attitude. We all had to place recovery above everything, for without recovery, we have lost both home and business. There it is again. Whatever you put in front of your recovery, if you're a real alcoholic, it is history. Can you have every confidence in his ability to recover? While on the subject of confidence, can you adopt the attitude that so far as you are concerned, this will be a strictly personal matter, that his alcoholic derelictions, the treatment about to be undertaken, will never be discussed without his consent? It might be well to have a long chat with him on his return. To return to the subject matter of this book, it contains full suggestions by which the employee may solve his problem. To you, some of the ideas which it contains are novel. Perhaps you are not quite in sympathy with the approach we suggest. By no means do we offer it as the last word on the subject, but so far as we are concerned, it has worked for us. And this really is the attitude of the Big Book. The Big Book says we are not the only way to find a relationship with God, but the spiritual exercises that we lay out have worked for so many of us that it's certainly highly recommended. Are you not looking for results rather than methods? Whether your employee likes it or not, he will learn the grim truth about alcoholism. That won't hurt him a bit, even though he does not go for this remedy. We suggest you draw the book to his attention of the doctor who is to attend your patient during treatment. If the book is read the moment the patient is able, while acutely depressed, realization of his condition may come to him. Again, hit them when they're down. Get them when they're pitifully and incomprehensibly demoralized. It's fun, too. We hope the doctor will tell the patient the truth about his condition, whatever that happens to be. When the man is presented with this volume, it is best that no one tell him he must abide by its suggestions. The man must decide for himself. You are betting, of course, that your changed attitude plus the contents of this book will turn the trick. In some cases it will, and in other cases it may not. But we think that if you persevere, the percentage of successes will gratify you. That's what I've found through my experience working with others, that the percentages go up the closer I follow the big book recommendations. I especially found that in working with others, because I used to work with others the way I thought I should work with others. I just took, just kind of went by the seat of my pants. And when I started using the chapter working with others, I got better results and wasted a hell of a lot less time. As your work spreads and our numbers increase, we hope your employees may be put in personal contact with some of us. Meanwhile, we are sure a great deal can be accomplished by the use of this book alone. What do you think about that? A whole lot can be accomplished on your recovery without any other people around with this book alone. Now, I have not found that in my own personal experience. I needed Alcoholics Anonymous, as well as the book, as well as service and all kinds of things. But what about the loners? You go to an international convention, and people from all over the world come to these conventions, and they're loners. They haven't been to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting in sometimes years. They get and stay sober on the big book and on correspondence to other people, which if you also read the big book, you'll see they actively ask for correspondence at a few times in this book. Please write the general. We'd love to hear from you. So this is a way that will work with some people. I don't know if it would work with me. It might. Who knows? When your employees return, talk with him. Ask him if he thinks he has the answer. If he feels free to discuss his problems with you, if he knows you understand and will not be upset by anything he wishes to say, he will probably be off to a fast start. I just got this the other day. It's called Practice the Principles and What is the Oxford Group? It's Bill Pittman, one of the AA historians. He's a little more heavily allied with Hazelton than I would like. But anyway, he does some decent work, and what this is the second part of this book is an exact reprint of a book called What is the Oxford Group, written by the layman with a notebook. It was an anonymously written book, and as far as the Oxford Group was concerned, it was the Oxford Group big book. In other words, like we have Alcoholics Anonymous text for our fellowship, the Oxford Group usually would pass around What is the Oxford Group, which basically laid out all their spiritual principles and how they worked their spiritual rejuvenation process. And as most of us know, Alcoholics Anonymous came from the Oxford Group. It was birthed out of the Oxford Group principles. And besides Bill Wilson, there was a whole bunch of people that were getting sober in the late 20s and early 30s in the Oxford Group. There was a little mecca of activity centering around the Calvary Church in New York City. And Sam Shoemaker was the minister there, and he was quite effective in carrying the message to suffering people of all types, not just alcoholics, anybody with any type of spiritual illness. A lot of great things were happening there. And something many people don't know is there was a number of books written by recovered alcoholics around that time. One of them was I Was a Pagan. I always loved that title. There was a couple more. I can't really remember them right now. But this one, I'm going to read an excerpt out of one of them by Charles Clapp Jr. He was one of the Oxford groupers right around New York City with Bill Wilson. I'm sure he knew and went to meetings with Bill Wilson. But he wrote a book called The Big Bender. And I'm just going to read a little excerpt out of it. And everybody just kind of keep in mind how our process of the 12 steps works while I read this. Now, this was written before anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous or Bill Wilson or Dr. Bob put any kind of pen to paper. This was written before that. So this will give you an idea of kind of where we came from. It was not long before I was again on a bender of 3 days' duration. The third loop occurred in early October, and I was landed in town, New York City, before it had ended. There, a former drunk who had completely given up drinking after coming in touch with the Oxford group cornered me. We spent several hours together, and I honestly faced not only the problem of liquor itself, but all the things underneath and back of it all which had caused me to drink. For the first time, I admitted drinking had me licked. When I drank, I lost control of myself, and I was the most selfish human being on earth. I definitely determined to turn my life over to God and try to straighten out all the messes I had caused and to pay whatever price was necessary to get my life as nearly as I could on a basis of absolute honesty, purity, unselfishness, and love. Since that day in October 1935, I have not had a drink. On the way to test quickly a thought or plan is to see, one way to test quickly a thought or a plan is to see if it conflicts with any one of the four standards. Absolute honesty, absolute purity, absolute unselfishness, and absolute love. This is something we kind of cut out of our program because they came to the conclusion that an alcoholic can't be absolutely honest or can't be absolutely anything else. You know, we're just way too messed up for that. That's just too high of a standard for us to yardstick for us to be able to measure up to. It is a certainty God is not going to tell me to do anything which will violate any of these. Should a thought or a plan of great moment, or one about which there was some doubt, come to me, I check it with others who are living on that basis. One of the Oxford Group things was checking guidance, which Alcoholics Anonymous really doesn't do a whole lot, except it kind of tells you to talk to a sponsor or a spiritual advisor about important things. Checking is done by talking it all over, clearly and honestly, praying about it, and seeing whether it seems right. I have not become absolutely honest, pure, unselfish, and loving. No, nowhere near. But whereas I used to be a drunk, now I don't drink at all. I used to think of no one but myself. Now I endeavor to be considerate of others. I used to lie when I felt like it. Now I try to tell the truth. I used to look down on most people. Now I see qualities in them which I never knew existed. I used to be restless and unhappy. Now I am calm and happy. I used to think the other fellow was always wrong. Now I do not. I used to feel that conditions, times, the town, the state, the country, and the world were at fault and should be changed. Now I realize it is individuals like myself who need to change. I know I have found a formula for my own life which works better than any I have known. Believe me, from where I sit, the future looks fascinating, full of adventure, action, romance, happiness, and tremendous hope. And this is somebody who had recovered from alcoholism through the Oxford Group. Tonight we're going to finish up the chapter to employers, I believe. And I like to look at the later chapters in the Big Book after working with others as practicing the principles chapters. It tells us in the 12th step to practice these principles in all of our affairs. I think there's many, many principles in these following chapters that are good to look at. We're going to start on page 145, paragraph 1. In this connection, can you remain undisturbed if the man proceeds to tell you shocking things? He may, for example, reveal that he has padded his expense account or that he has planned to take your best customers away from you. Remember, this is a kind of a guide to employers. Like, you're going to be working with an alcoholic if he's willing to get sober. You know, these are some of the things that they had found that worked, and these are some guiding principles. In fact, he may say almost anything if he has accepted our solution, which, as you know, demands rigorous honesty. Can you charge this off as if you would a bad account and start fresh with him? If he owes you money, you may wish to make terms. So it's kind of warning the employer that if the alcoholic is going to be practicing a program, he's probably going to be making amends to you. Very few times does an alcoholic work a long period of time for somebody and not owe an amends. You know what I mean? If he speaks of his home situation, you can undoubtedly make helpful suggestions. Can he talk frankly?